Man, it's pretty cool to see some guy that might have lived, you know, never even experienced surfing.
Yeah.
And now he's like living at the beach surfing, and that's all he wants to do. Because anyone I've ever met that never had that in their life and they've done it, they get like fanatical with it, man.
Yeah.
Like, and that's pretty rad.
Hello and welcome to the Smorgasborder Podcast. I'm your host, Dave Swan. Today, our podcast interview is conducted by new Smorgasborder team member, Alex Benno. Alex is a keen Sunshine Coast surfer, photographer, intrepid traveler and journo, and he recently sat down with the Rooster, shaper and self-described hillbilly from Tennessee. And what an absolute ripper interview this is. This guy has really experienced life. Greg Weber is his name, and he is the man behind Rooster Brand Surfboards. And wow, has he got some stories to tell. The Rooster has worked with legends of the surf industry. Hell, he was the pro team glasser at Lost Surfboards for over 10 years. He's surfed against the likes of CJ and Damien Hopgood. He's partied with Jay Adams in Hawaii. He even learned to screen print from none other than Lords of Dogtown legend Skip Engbloom. The Rooster is one colourful character. He's absorbed it all and become a talented, passionate and well-respected craftsman with a no-bullshit attitude. Sit back and relax because you will be enthralled with this one. This episode of our podcast is brought to you by Visit Noosa, proud sponsors of the iconic Noosa Festival of Surfing, which morphs today until Sunday into the newly minted World Surf League's first round of the 2019 World Longboard Tour. Righto, as Alison Chains once said, here come the Rooster.
Oh, okay. Wow. That's kind of a funny story because I was actually born in Nashville, Tennessee. Well, right outside of Nashville. I was born in Lynchburg where Jack Daniels is made.
Yeah, okay.
It's like a little town. There's probably like 3,000 people there, but during the census back when I was born. So, yeah, I was kind of born in the hills and never even assumed I was ever going to be a surfer.
Yeah, I know. How'd you get your relation with surfing?
So,
how'd you get into the surfing scene?
I had a stepfather. My mother remarried when I was seven, and my stepdad was an engineer. So he used to get a lot of contracts with the military bases, and he would design like the wind tunnels for some of the big like aircraft and like the C-130 and the Blackbird and all that. And so I got the opportunities to start traveling because we had basically had to move around with these contracts. So I was in Tennessee till I was 11 and I moved to Cocoa Beach, Florida.
Yeah, right.
And I was already into skateboarding just kind of that subculture. And I'd seen surfing and TV and stuff. I was like, that was pretty cool, Never assumed that was going to be my path later on. But we moved to Cocoa Beach, Florida. And then I got into surfing because there was my neighbors. His name was Brandon. I think he was like 17. I was 11. And he was a surfer. And my mom was just like, I want to go surfing, and Brandon took me surfing and brought a board. And
okay.
So, I started getting into surfing there. And then, like, every 2 years we moved around. So I moved to another part of Florida. Actually, I moved to the Gulf Coast. And, there's actually, believe it or not, waves there.
Yeah, true.
Rarely. But then from there, I went to Virginia Beach. So on the east coast of America, Virginia Beach is, like, the epicenter. It's, like, of surfing. And especially with manufacturing. And by that time, I was around 13, and I started hanging out instead. Like, you got to get a job.
Yeah,
I didn't want to go cut lawns or work in the local shop or wash dishes. So, my mom took me to the local factory, and they were actually the biggest manufacturers on the East Coast during the 80s and 90s. WRV surfboards, and I got my first job there at 13, cleaning toilets and sweeping floors and taking out trash and rolling cigarettes for the glasser and. And then I got to cut the cloth and dress the boards for the glasser. And then by the time I was 16, I was, like, full-fledged. Like, I'd learned everything. And I was, I was a sander. I sand in Tennessee. I was, So then from there, Virginia Beach, I moved to North Carolina because that's where the big factory was. It was just a two-hour distance from Virginia Beach to the Outer Banks of North Carolina. It's a little barrier island off the coast of North Carolina that the big manufacturing facility was. And the headquarters is in Virginia Beach.
Okay.
So then I went from there. I was a production manager of that, so I worked my way up and still on the tools. Yep. And then I took off to Cali at 16. I finished school. So my mom, well, I had a little bit of a surfing career. So yep. I was on the ESA's Eastern Surfing Association. Like I grew up like surfing against like Damien Hoggus, CJ Slater. Yeah, wow. Slater was a couple years older. He was in another league.
Yeah.
So and then there's some other great surfers, Kyle Garson, all of the really good Florida guys. They were really competitive, you know.
So at that stage, did you you're going to be a surfer or a shaper?
Well, I thought I was going to try to have the dream of chasing the surfer, you know, but. Then, like, kind of, I've always got a backup plan, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the main thing.
So when I went out to California to make my start, especially I was like, well, now I'm joining the NWSA, and it's like, you know, I'm surfing against, you know, Greg Brown or Chris Brown, and just like some bigger names.
Yeah, you thought it was sort of taking off.
Yeah, and then I was like, shit, man, I'm not really going to make the cut.
Get to that certain age where you got to choose.
Yeah, so, you know, and I just really focused on surfing, and then, like, because, like, it was very limited with, I focused on the manufacturing side of things, and very limited with on the East Coast. There's we were the biggest manufacturer, and there's a few backyard guys. But once I got to California, you know, I was in the big leagues, man. Yeah. Like, I got to work some of the greats, you know, and influenced by some of the greats. Yeah. And I was just like, screw trying to be a pro surfer. I'm going to be a shaper and a glasser, you know, craftsman, you know.
And those guys would have inspired you heaps.
They did.
Know,
and so blessed to have had some of the great, great influences. Jim Fuller, who taught Biolis. Robert Manville, he was an original Dewey Weber shaper and Hap Jacobs shaper. I got to work. Then some of the older guys. Then I got some of the newer generations. It was like Tyler Hedzikian. Obviously, Matt Biolis. Matt Biolis has been a really, you know, big influence. I mean, even though we're kind of the same era and we'd worked together, I'm originally old Lost Family since '92. I started with those guys, you know. Matt was a, you know, big impact.
Yeah. Do you still keep in touch with him?
Yeah, I still talk to Matt all the time. Yeah, I do a lot of consulting work for Lost still.
Oh, okay.
So I was their team glosser for like 10 years. So I pretty much did only like the team boards. Someone was the other day talking to me. Awesome. I said, I've probably done more world title boards than most people have had hot meals just glossing. So I was a glosser. I mean, I was a shaper the whole time too, but like, man, when I got to California, like, the shapers are a dime a dozen, and it's like so competitive. And I was like, you know what? These guys are struggling to find work, have work, get orders. I wouldn't become just the bridesmaid. I was the glosser for all the big labels, you know.
Yeah.
So I was like, should I always got work? And during that time, I was still pushing my boards on the side, and you know, like, honestly, being around Matt, Timmy Patterson. For the record, Timmy Patterson is God to me.
Yep.
For a shaper.
Yeah, not for sure.
And as a craftsman, and I also really respected guys that were not just. When I first started learning how to make boards, I wanted to learn everything. I didn't want to just be a glosser or a sander or a fin guy. So a lot of the guys that were doing start-to-finish stuff, like Timmy Patterson, I was really drawn to those guys because they weren't just a shaper.
And were you thinking, like, further down the track, I want to be able to do everything by myself?
Well, yeah,
you know?
By the time I was already 16, I had already done everything by myself. Yeah. So I was gravitated to those guys.
Yeah.
You know, there was times where I had to work for the guys that was the big favorite of my shaper.
Yep.
I just feel real blessed with some of the influences and the guys that I had the opportunity to work with. I mean, there's so many to name. I could sit here and take an hour of naming all these great influences. But
at that stage, did you think, you know, like, one day I'm going to go out on my own and I'm going to create my own
brand? Yes, I did. But I did get kind of, like, pigeonholed in being, like, the glasser to the stars.
Yeah.
Or, you know, or the sander and the glosser, you know, whether I'd get bored of one job and jump into sanding for a couple of months, go back to glossing, mainly completes.
Yeah.
But, I really enjoyed shaping, and I made a lot of boards for my mates, and a lot of, like, I like to do really a lot of weird experimental stuff instead of what everyone else is doing. So mates gave me the opportunity to keep ordering boards off of me.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always still shaped, but obviously my bread and butter was the glossing, and,
That's right. And then moving out to Australia, what?
So 16 years old, Cali was my home base.
Yeah.
But I traveled. Like, I've worked in every continent, you know. I did 10 solid seasons on the North Shore during the winter, living at Sunset, and that's a whole nother.
And that's one thing I wanted to talk to you about. I saw on your Instagram you've got, like, 100% skateboarder jump given to you by Jay Adams.
Yeah, so Jay, well, kind of grown up in Venice area you know, at the 16 age. I feel like I've grown up in all these different places.
Yeah.
Got all these different metamorphoses in my life. But Jay, because I worked with the Venice crew a lot. Skip Engblom was a very big mentor to me because I was in the factory that he was working at. He was doing dings at the time. And so I got to really know all the, those, because the original shop was called Natural Progression. Then it became, that was back in the 70s and then it in the 80s. And then it, after the Dogtown era kind of died, this is after Z Boys, which Skip started Z Boys. It was called the Aquatech Factory, and it was in Venice. And it was still the same guys, the same core Venice crew, like Perry Farrell from Jane's Addiction was part of the crew. He was coming, getting boards, hanging out of the factory. Mike and Jim Muir from Suicidal and Dogtown. Mike Clark, the guitar player, ended up being a really good friend of mine. I used to travel with him and stuff.
Man, that's
and
so cool.
So it was really, really cool to have an opportunity to actually, that's probably my highlight, you know.
Yeah.
Just the way I was molded, Skip, you know. He was definitely my biggest, biggest influence and motivator. And, shit, I wouldn't be anywhere without that guy.
So cool to hear.
So I got like that surf culture and the skate culture together. And Venice is dirty. It's rugged. It's paradise. You know, it's street.
That's it.
You know, and there was so much different stuff during that time. You know, like you had like, so the Venice Breakwater area, it used to be called Ghost Town because the gangs were so bad in that area. You didn't really go down there, but the surfers, we would go down there and like, you know, your gangbangers are looking at us like, what are these guys? They're surfers. And then we talk to them and like, you guys are crazy going surfing, man. There's like sharks out there. And I'm like, you guys are crazy. Carry guns.
For sure.
So, but it was a really kind of cool culture happening out of there at that time, you know. It was skate, punk, a little bit of that whole cholo scene, you know, the vato scene, which is...
Is that sort of like, you know, do you show that through your boards
today? Maybe a little bit. I'm definitely a little bit more like on the whole kind of raw street, kind of what I was brought up around. But yeah, that was a great opportunity. And then I moved down to more like, L.A. was always my home base.
Yeah.
So around the Venice area, Redondo Beach, Hermosa Beach. And that's where surfing started in the United States. Duke Conomoca came over and taught the guys in Palos Verdes, which is the South Bay. Kind of where I grew up in that area. Venice was the north end of the South Bay. But then I took off and went down to Orange County to get into the circuits because that's where all the big labels were, you know?
Yeah.
So,
the moving to Australia.
So, anyways, I was in Hawaii because I'd kind of had a gut full of like Cali. It was just getting too crazy, just too many people and just. I love California, you know, but I'd had my time, you know.
Yeah, you'd spent your time there. You want something different, I guess.
And, like, I was traveling to Mexico. I was traveling to Central America and South America, some for work, some for surfing. And every time I went somewhere, I was like, oh, this is a really cool place, but I couldn't really want to live here.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Can't say long-term future, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, as we, like, visit somewhere, like, oh, man, I could live here, but really, you got to think about it. We're so, like, programmed to be, like, first world.
Yeah.
You go to these third world countries, and you're like, well, this is going to be cool for maybe 2 or 3 months, and then I'm just going to do my head, and I got to...
Yeah, exactly. You know? You can't...
So, I actually was about to move to Hawaii, because I was doing the winters there, and I was like... And I had a big factory in Los Angeles at the time. I was doing about 120 boards a week, so I'd moved away from Lost and was independent with my own glass shop. So I was doing, like, 60 for Merrick, 60 for Lost a week. Had an epoxy factory going as well inside our big PE factory. And then I was like humming and hawing, like, so I had a pretty good life in Cali, you know. I lived on the beach, had some classic cars, had my little group of friends, my factory.
Yeah.
You know,
working
I like
with the big names.
Living with the big names. Yeah. If I want to go to Hollywood, you know, I'm not all surfer, I liked a little bit of flavor.
Yeah.
You know, and then finally I was like, you know, I get out of this rat race. So I was going to Hawaii and I really like locked in Hawaii. I stayed with a good family over there, I had no hassles there, I had a little glassing bay, shaping bay.
Yeah.
I got to work next door to Jack Rees, which is another icon glasser craftsman, and I was gonna live there, eventually make the full move. And then one of my really close mates, Daniel McDonald, DMS Surfboards, who was living with me prior, a few years before, working with us at Lost, he'd come back to Australia and he kept hassling me to come over, and he got the Honolulu Surf Company license.
Yeah.
And he set his factory up. He just kept hassling me to come over. And I was like, man, I'm kind of like, think I'm just going to stay.
What are you saying? Come
shore.
Over. It's going to take off here.
So yeah, he's like, I'm a fact. Yeah, I need your help. And finally, he talked me into it, and I came over, and then I was here for like 90 days, and then I actually met my daughter's mom, and then I was like, you know what, Australia is kind of like America, but yet it's different, so I could live here.
Yeah, no, a lot of similarities.
Like,
definitely.
I know after 2 months' time, I wasn't going to go, oh man, I got to get back to society, because it's close, it's very similarities, even though it's a lot more laid back, so that's what kept me here.
Yeah,
and there's
you could see a long term future.
Absolutely.
Instead of those places
and then
like
once
Venice,
I
when
saw
you
Kira,
said you
I, mean, yeah. I was a 13-year-old kid looking in the magazines and seeing like Center Spreads of Kira, and I was like, man, I got to live there one day. So I never assumed I was ever going to live here.
Yeah,
and it was actually my first trip ever made to Australia. I mean, I'd been to Indo heaps of times Southeast Asia, but I never quite
never
had gone
to. Australia.
And then once I got here, I was like, yeah, I think this is what I'm going to do now.
So, and then when you started up Rooster Brand, when was that?
So I had a few side labels, obviously being a shaper as well, and like in Hawaii, everybody used to call me the hillbilly. So and because the way I guess my accent, I come from Tennessee.
And, yeah, in the hills.
So that was a novelty. So I shaped under that, and I just thought that name was a little bit kind of childish in a way. And I've also, my nickname's been the Rooster too my whole life.
Yeah,
and,
where did that come from?
I think because I'm kind of very, I look after people, and I'm kind of like a rooster.
So, yeah,
I protect my flock.
Yeah, yeah, rooster looks after the chickens.
Yeah,
so
I look after things.
Protector,
kind of a protector.
Yeah.
So yeah, I had that, and then also being a short guy and very like vigorous and ambitious.
Yeah,
and,
just
you know,
came from your characteristics
as a
person.
Yeah. So I was doing all the rounds here because once I moved here, I had to start over and do all the rounds, all the factories, and make my name. And I kind of got tired of working a lot along the factories, and again because no one kind of got along and there's no camaraderie like I was used to at home. So I was like, you know what? I've always had been appreciated for my craft and my passion and my thoroughness of what I do and the integrity of what I do. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to go off on my own, and I'm going to do some contract glassing. So obviously that's your bread and butter. And then I just started pumping my boards again on the side, and I just said, well, I'm going to just call it Rooster Brand. I don't want to be just known as a surfboard. You know, I have a brand. You know, I do clothes, skateboards,
for sure. And
but
that's
mainly
thing,
surfing's
you know?
my backbone.
You got your custom tees as well that you
I do. Yeah, all my custom stuff is handmade. Custom, everything I do is handmade. At home, I have a screen printing factory as well. Which I got to owe that to Skip. He taught me about screen printing. He didn't teach me. He relaunched Santa Monica Airlines after the whole Dogtown thing died, and he's like, hey, kid, you're going to, like, learn how to screen print. And I'm like, Skip, man, I don't know how to screen print. And he brings all this shit to me. And it was, like, the real old school days, you know, like Ruby Red Vellum. And you got to make your own stencils and stuff instead of having it on Photoshop and Illustrator, you know. And, he just kind of threw me in the deep end. And
Learning from Skip Eagle, that's it.
Skip was just, he was, like, the guy that would just push you to go. And then, like.
Yeah, I guess he sort of had, you know. I'm referring to Lords of the Dogtown, the video. You know, you sort of had that father figure.
He did. And I guess back to the Jay Adams thing. Yeah. So, anyways, I got to know Jay a little bit in Cali. You know, obviously in Venice and the scene, and he was going back and forth from Hawaii jail back to California.
Yeah, yeah, a bit of a.
But boy. I was living at Velzy Land 1 year, just briefly before I moved to Sunset, my permit location was at, and he lived two houses down and. We were going to a Halloween party. It was a bit cold because they always had the annual Halloween party at Waimea, you know? Like you've seen in the movie The North Shore where they had the Halloween. That's true. It does. I mean, Jay's like, oh, I got a you can borrow this. You can have this jacket. And it was one of his 100% skateboards. So it was like one of my heirlooms.
Yeah. So, but at this stage, you were just like, all right, give us that jacket.
Yeah.
Know,
he was just a normal dude. He's a Venice boy, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's not like a thing. This is
people
Jay
were
Adams.
Like, oh, Jay Adams was like, he was just like one of the boys would go hang out and surf with,
that's
you know?
Such
like,
cool thing.
But now it's like, obviously, Jay's recognized and skipping the whole scene. And it's like, I feel very gifted, not even to got to know those guys, but to actually have something like that. So, it's one of my most prized possessions.
That is cool. Well, that was from my curiosity.
Australia. So, I ended up coming here on accident.
Yeah.
And working with Dan and met my daughter's mom. And we went back to Cali for a little while to kind of see how It's like I had a lot of shit going on there. Yeah, you know, no, good stuff going in.
Your roots, yeah.
Then, like, we got pregnant, and I was like, shit, man, there's no way I'm going to raise my kid in Cali. I want to get out of here anyways. And then my wife at the time, she's a North Stratty girl, and so, man, it's going to be a much better life for us. So we migrated here. I packed up, sold everything, and just walked away from everything I built, and I came here and started everything.
Yeah.
But not once have I looked back and regretted it.
No, for sure, man. Definitely, that's the way to go. And living at Talibudra?
Yeah.
In the valley?
Yeah.
So tell us a bit about your... Because we didn't get it on record before.
Yeah,
the organic sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I was in Currumbin for the whole time I'd moved here for the first... I've been here 15 years. So the first 10 years, I was in Currumbin Waters, and on the river, and it's nice, but it's still kind of suburbia. But I always wanted to get back to my roots, being out on land, I was in Tennessee.
I
and
for
kind
sure.
of back to the hillbilly, you know? And, man, I lucked into this great property, and I built my factory up there, and then... yeah, man, I haven't looked back. It's been, I feel so blessed.
Definitely.
Even if I won the lottery, it wouldn't even make me as happy as what I have. That's,
you wouldn't move, yeah. For
yeah.
Sure, man. Oh, that's good. What else did I have? So, yeah, tell us a bit about your shapes. You know, I've seen online you got your performance, the retro, hybrid.
Yep.
You also shape for Groms.
Yep.
And then you're talking before about your bio.
Yeah, I'm working on some bio projects right now. I've got two prototypes about to come out. Obviously, you know, all those years being a glosser for the Stars, you know, my basis and foundation was a lot of performance stuff. But then the old guys that taught me were the guys coming from the 50s and the 60s that were shaping for, you know, Velzy and Hap Jacobs. And I was like, man, I really liked all that retro stuff too, but it just wasn't a lot going on. And then... And I always made that kind of stuff for myself and my mates.
Yeah,
but,
but
I never
wanted to
be pigeonholed as just a performer. I mean, obviously my background was performance, you know?
Yeah, working with those big names.
Yeah, but I didn't want to be pigeonholed because I don't even really ride performance boards. My performance board is like a Twinser, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I was really loved that. I think I was born a generation too late because I kind of frothed on what the guys in this... I would have loved to have been like... In my early 20s and the 70s, you know, hanging out, especially in the Malibu, Los Angeles area, there's some great surfers great innovators. And I try to do a broad spectrum of stuff, retro, a lot of experimental stuff. Like, if you come up with some crazy idea, and I'm like, let's make it happen.
Yeah.
You know? I think a lot of my performance stuff's probably my biggest seller.
Yeah.
But again, like, I'm trying to keep it kind of an even balance where I'm not just a performance guy. But my epoxy stuff is really what I'm known for.
Yeah.
And, I've been doing epoxy for years, even when it wasn't, like, acceptable 20 years ago.
Yeah.
I was glossing paddle boards and windsurf boards. So I'd had this big history. Smorgasbord. So I had this big history of the epoxy already. And I knew the revolution was going to come with epoxy, especially after Clark Foam closed. And we were so reliant on Clark Foam. It's like, shit, man. People are like, oh, we got to start doing epoxy now because that's the only thing we have access to.
Yep.
Like, calm down, guys. PE blanks are going to be back on the rise. Someone's going to fill the gap.
Yeah.
But thank God you guys are starting to recognize this now because epoxy's really cool stuff, you know. And so, it's definitely carved my niche out here in Australia because it's one of my specialties. I do a lot of traveling, Matt sent me around the world doing some stuff for...
I've seen working in third world countries.
Yeah, well, I've been in a lot of third world backyard. I've done a lot of working in the backyard shops, teaching guys. But, you know, I worked at Pukas for a long time. You know, I've done some of the bigger stuff, bigger factories in Indo. I've been in South Africa, you know, with some of the bigger factories. So I'm actually a consultant. So I could do some consulting for, like, shapers, kinetics resin. Matt sends me on some gigs, just to basically companies in the world find out about me through reference, usually through shapers who would promote me a lot. And then so I'll get sent over and I'll train a crew. Like, I was just in South Africa last year. I trained Clayton's crew and to do all the spine tech. So I had a lot to do, help Dan. Well, Dan designed the carbon wrap. I helped him with pretty much the development, production of it. And then that's what sent me around doing. Matt sent me around once they bought the license.
Yep.
Spine Tech as well. I've done some consulting for, you know, Channel Islands for Indonesia as well, their manufacturing. So I kind of as a consultant as far as epoxy composites go as well. Actually, I set Puka's whole epoxy program up 7 years ago. They weren't even, knew nothing about epoxies. And Matt sent me over and I set their whole epoxy program up. So I guess I've kind of have gotten a little bit pigeonholed with being an epoxy guy, but I do PU, I do color work, I do gloss polishes, you know, just whatever comes my way, I'll do whatever. But just I guess I'm the epoxy guy, so, and you know, there's never been a shortage of work for me since I was in my factory with epoxy.
That's a good thing. At the end of the day, everyone calls me. You do have to pay the bills.
And yeah, and everyone's like, "Are you an epoxy guru?" I'm like, "No, I'm not really. I just have patience for it because you got to be real patient with epoxy." So,
okay.
Anything challenging, I really enjoy because I get bored easy. So
so well, that's right. You always give yourself new challenges.
So predictable. And... You have like four boards went perfect.
Yep.
And the next four, you're like, what happened? You know? I've already worked out all those kinks, but and I really like passing my knowledge on to other guys.
Yeah. Okay.
That's something that I feel is very important. Progression for our industry. You know,
well, maybe that's you know sort of a future thing that you'll look. Towards mentoring.
Ideally, I really would like to run like a program for people that want to learn. But obviously, we have a shortage of those people that want to learn. You know.
Yeah, well, that's right.
But I've taught a lot of guys along the way. You know, I've got some a lot of success stories with guys that have done really good, and you know, and a lot of guys that
gave it a crack. It could work, you know.
Yeah, well, I think a few years ago, I've done a lot of mentoring in this industry, but. You know, I'd like to do something more structured. And a few, I don't know, about 8 years ago, they're trying to get it recognized as a skilled trade here.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and unfortunately, the drivers of that program kind of didn't have their homework together, and they were kind of the wrong representatives of...
The wrong people to give advice and mentor.
Well, it looked like a pissing match between a bunch of guys trying to make something happen by the government, getting it recognized, and the government looking at us like, you guys aren't even organized. What do you want? That's why I didn't get recognized. So. But, hopefully in the future it may get recognized. Because I also have a diploma in training and assessment. I had like a midlife surfboard crisis. I quit doing boards. Also.
Yeah.
I quit doing boards in... I didn't quit doing boards. I just... did them part-time for a few years. I went to uni, became a social worker.
Took a bit of a hiatus.
Yeah, so I went to uni, became a social worker, and that, like, really excelled quickly. I prospered well. I was very, I guess, successful in the beginning as far as, like, anything I do, I'm going to go full throttle with it.
Yeah, you're 110%.
And, everything kind of progressed really quickly, and I ended up having a job my first year in uni, and then I ended up finishing I got a diploma in welfare services, diploma in community services, and upon my training assessment, which I can teach at TAFE. I can teach a course. I can write a curriculum up, accredit your units for it, and give you a certain four and something. But
really
hopefully
cool.
One day it does get recognized. I can be a surfboard teacher.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure, you know, going the way we are, that could be something.
Or a farmer. That's my other backup plan.
Yeah. Well, you know, you got a passion for the organic life.
And coming from LA, too, you know, you're like, it's so plastic consumable there. Everything's just consumer-based society. And here I'm like, oh, this is pretty cool, man. You know?
Yeah, and I think it's something that will take off, you know? With the whole global warming and, you know, quitting plastic.
Well, everybody, everyone's, it's so hot this winter, this summer compared to last summer. And we have less rain, and I go, that's global warming. I don't believe in that. I go, well, what are you basing your theories on? Because we've consumed this earth, and that's why everything's changing. You know, we're depleting our resources. There is a such thing as global warming. You know,
I know. Some people have a bit of trouble facing the facts.
Yeah, I think it's because it's not convenient for them. People always take the convenient route.
Yeah,
and you got to work a little bit harder to make something that's going to be sustainable. Yeah. And we do, unfortunately, our society is a very, consumer-based, discard, you know, our rubbish, discard.
Yeah, well, they think more about making the money than what the long-term effects are going to be.
Yeah, it's all about convenience, you know. It's like, it's more convenient for me to get a takeaway coffee and just throw the plastic cup away than to me to have a mug of coffee and bring your mug. The bag thing happening right now is awesome at the shops, you know. Definitely. It's like...
And then we got a thing up in Queensland, I don't know if you know, like the bottle collection.
Yeah, absolutely. Because I know South Australia did it for years.
Yep.
And they still are.
Yeah, that's true.
And I think that's an incentive. If you start giving... Unfortunately, society's driven by money. So if you can give somebody...
Exactly,
you've
got to have something that entices them.
Yeah, you know? I might get 10 cents for this, I get 50 cans, I might get, $5.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes to get people to start geared in that direction.
That's what they're
going to
do.
You know, but...
Unfortunately, money revolves.
Yes, unfortunately. Everyone's like, money doesn't buy happiness. Money does not buy happiness.
No.
Money buys you opportunities, though. Money buys you convenience. Yeah. You know?
Exactly. And as much as you want to go against, you know, you don't need money, all this.
And unfortunately, we do. I mean, I'd love if we still traded in salts and furs and gold and frankincense like we did back in the old days. But unfortunately, you know,
that's not the way it is.
It's not how it is. But if you just don't let the money consume, like, I don't ever want, you know, my whole thing is, what's your goal? My goal is just to make surfboards and be happy. I don't want to be a DH or a JS. You know, great on those guys, but that's not my trip. I didn't get into this shit to get rich to be.
No, exactly. You've done it because it's your passion.
I do because this is what I do, and it's something I'm good at. You know, one of the few things in this earth, but. Yeah. So, yeah.
No, for sure, man. If you're doing something that you like, you know, like you said,
well, to me, that's worth more than any amount of money.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But yeah, basically, you know, like I was saying before, you know, working with those big names, did they sort of inspire you with your shapes?
Oh.
Or does that come from something else?
No, definitely, man. Glass and So Many Mayhems and Timmy Patterson's and Hamish Graham's. That was definitely, like, it influenced a lot. Like,
yeah.
Performance, you know, yeah. and just on all kinds of levels too, like with just the integrity of your business and one thing I really admire about Matt, I mean, me and Matt had a lot of time together. You know, I was obviously his glosser for a long time, and you know, obviously you got your ups and downs, and there's times it probably was, you know, a pain in his ass or, you know, vice versa. But Matt's done so much for the progression of this industry to kind of legitimize what we do and still stay core to, like, our cause.
Do you believe so?
And yeah, I really, you know, I think Matt's done a lot, you know, and so I have a lot of, you know, respect and for what he's done. Timmy Patterson, again, one of the greatest craftsmen I've ever, you know, encountered to work with.
And, you know, someone that's learned everything, you know,
yeah,
from shaping, glass.
Exactly. I mean, like I said, there's so many today, man. There's so many great guys that I've had the opportunity to work with. And
you've taken something from it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of guys that people haven't heard of that are, like, actually in our circle. They're stars, you know? Like, they're the real stars.
But they're just not up in the line.
They're just the unsung heroes, you know? Because they just want to...
Unsung heroes.
I mean, the whole thing about being a surfer is we're different. We're, like, elusive, you know?
Yeah.
Like, unfortunately, commercialism's gotten into it. But there's a lot of great craftsmen out there that, you know, like, only if you're in the game, you know who they are.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's...
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, there's so many names. And, you know, definitely. Oh, thank you.
Tummy jerk. It's Konami. It's all good.
Yeah, go for it.
Thanks, bro. But, yeah, no, definitely.
And growing up around a lot of good surfers, especially, like, in the Los Angeles area, man, like Malibu had its scene, you know, South Los Angeles County had its scene, Orange County had its scene, San Diego County, Santa Cruz. I went and did, like, a six-month stint up there to kind of, like, guys, check out what Santa Cruz is about. That was interesting. A lot of crazy stuff going on in Santa Cruz.
I would have loved to be around in that time.
Yeah, it was really good. Unfortunately, the Santa Cruz scene, you had so much talent coming out of there, but so much, like, broken homes, a lot of really bad drugs scene up there, and, you know, lost some great people.
Yeah, you
would
have seen a lot of people, you know, get caught up in the wrong sort of shit.
And, yeah, and, you know, it's a couple guys have gone to prison, a couple guys have died. You know, some of the guys, I look at Flea, that guy got his shit together.
Yeah.
And he's doing a lot for the community in Santa Cruz. He's running Flea Hab, and that guy's just gnarly, man, at Mavs, you know. And back when he was winning those big comps, man, that guy was just high as shit, you know. And he's like, I was so, like, in my zone. That's how I was winning these days, surfing 50-foot Mavs and shit, you know. They're very, very, like, real, real hardcore, though, up in Santa Cruz.
Yeah,
and,
definitely.
You know,
they don't care about anything.
Yeah, it's
else,
definitely no commercialism up there,
that's
no,
it.
Whatsoever. You know?
It's got the core.
Yeah, it's either you perform or you're out, you know?
Oh, that's so cool to hear an inside story from what it was like back then, you know?
Yeah.
Because, like, I'm basing all my, you know, views on the Lords of the Dogtown story. I mean, that's probably the closest thing I've got to seeing what happened in those days. But then, you know, you lived it, you were there.
We could do a whole book on some of that stuff, the whole Dogtown, that era, those guys. I came on right at the end of the whole Dogtown thing, but there was still a lot of cool stuff going on, you know.
Yeah.
Like, actually, when Heath Ledger was learning Skip's part, And by the way, for the record, Heath Ledger played Skip to the T.
He was very accurate. You know,
so he was hanging around for like a year with Skip, pretty much learning his character. He was popping in the factory and going surfing Malibu. And he was a really interesting guy. And
you say he played it to the T.
To the T. He was Skip to the T. The Skip, I know, he did an amazing. He could not have asked for a better.
And what about guy. Jay and Tony and Stacy?
Yeah, well, Emil Hirsch, he did a great job with Jay. I think for me, well, I actually went to the premiere of the movie. It was just great. I went with Skip, so that was really cool. But I don't know. Just Skip to me is God. Yeah. And he played a big father figure to me. And he taught me so much, not even just about boards, but how to run a business.
No, that's
he
it.
Taught
I saw
me how to be
Skip,
a man.
Yeah.
He taught me how to be core to what I am and true to who I am.
Yeah,
so I got a lot of personal stuff out of him too. You know?
I saw that on Instagram. You know, you wrote, you know, I never had a father, so you know, I took inspiration from the people that
guys
I worked
that
with through,
me
throughout
that
the
I respected,
factory.
And guys that did what they said, you know, like a lot of guys don't do what they say, or you know, they're just kind of contradict. Those Skip was just he was just influential. I mean, the guy was a millionaire. He was broke. He was a millionaire. He's broke. You know, just like that guy's resilient, man, and he taught me resilience. So.
Yeah.
Cool being part of that in the beginning because that was very core and raw, you know, it's punk and but I definitely feel like I'm really happy with the path I chose.
Yeah.
You know, and I never did it for any kind of self recognition or notoriety. It was because
you followed your passion.
That's what I wanted to do. Surfing saved and making boards saved my life. I could have took so many other paths in life, especially with the influences around me.
Definitely with the influences around you. Like you said at Santa Cruz, for example.
Well, yeah, just even Los Angeles, you know, the LA area, you know. And you know, I had a lot of friends that did go other paths, you know, prison, drugs, dead, gangs. I was like, man, that didn't look like fun. I want to go to Mexico and go surfing or Indo and, you know, hang out with blondes on the beach and, you know. Jail didn't look interesting to me, you know.
Yeah.
Being strung out on drugs wasn't interesting to me, you know. Uh-huh. Like, I wanted to surf, and, you know, I wanted to be part of that culture. And I think I had the air I was in was a lot of part of it, too, because it was when it was core. Surfing was still dangerous. It was territorial.
Yeah.
You know, I'm
sort of really created the stereotype for a surf.
Well, we created a subculture, you know, and obviously it was before us, and... And I'm really stoked that it's gone. Everyone's like, oh, surfing's gotten so commercialism. But, man, it's kind of why it keeps us in work.
Yeah.
And I'm stoked to see people, like,
that's
really
it. It's
buying.
It's had to have a change, you know, to
you
keep
know?
Alive. And
we're no longer the outcast anymore, you know, which what drew us in the beginning to be that. But then it's like, well, we're kind of legitimized now.
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
We do have a purpose. And
stereotypes definitely changed.
Yeah.
And it's just been the popularity of the sport. Mm. A lot of people...
I see guys
people.
Like, you know, bitching about, oh, there's so many people out in the water. Well, I mean, I do think there needs to be some kind of education program with etiquette and stuff. Obviously, you're a beginner, you're not going to go out and surf snapper, but people do. I think there still needs to be a hierarchy and a pecking order, but, man, it's pretty cool to see some guy that might have lived, you know, never even experienced surfing. And then now he's, like, living at the beach surfing, and that's all he wants to do. Because anyone I've ever met that never had that in their life and they've done it, they get, like, fanatical with it, man.
Yeah.
Like, and that's pretty rad.
Definitely.
And just to be part of that
definitely.
Whole subculture.
And it's such a healthy thing to be doing.
Oh, surfing
you know?
Saved my life.
Yeah.
Like, I'm blessed.
I think it saved a lot of people's lives.
It has.
You know? But, yeah, no. It's good, man. I think, you know, we've covered a lot of stuff that I wanted to hear. We've got more than enough content. Definitely. Really interesting. An interesting character. I knew straight away you were going to be an interesting character just from looking at your Instagram. I knew.
A lot of people, sometimes I do put controversial stuff up there, but it's never a direct attack on people. It's more about educating people.
Yeah.
And I've had so many people come up and say to me, man, I wish I had the balls to say what you said.
Yeah.
And I'm
straight
like, well,
heart,
I've got nothing to lose, you know, because everyone who knows me in the industry knows that I stand up for what I believe in. I call bullshit when I see bullshit. But, you know, I'm not one to name and shame people because that's not cool. But, you know, like, just educating people and just trying to get us all to fucking get along, you know?
That's it.
Like,
you said before.
We're all the same subculture. Yeah. We all got into this for the same reason. Why we got inner turmoil? It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
And,
all the rivalries
and
stuff like
that. I think my biggest mission right now, or has been pretty much since I was in Australia, is to kind of work with everybody. Like, I'm kind of cool with everybody.
Yeah.
And then this guy will be, why are you cool with them? I'm like, well, because I respect what they're doing, and I'll give you that same respect, you know. So maybe I'm just trying to get people to open their eyes up, maybe be a bit of an influence. Like, I've had influences. I want to try to do that for other people.
Yeah, not to enjoy so what we do and
not
and
be so bitter
like
about what we do, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, the whole Chinese thing, man, everyone's all pissed off about these Chinese boards. Man, it's because we don't have any skilled workers left. There's no kids knocking down the doors to come in and want to learn how to be a glosser or a sander.
Exactly.
You know, and I don't have a problem with the Chinese boards, man. If you got to get your boards made, shit, man, I don't care who makes them.
Yeah, you got to get people that actually want to work,
you know. And it's our own fault because we're so closed-minded.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But,
That's 100%. No, I hear what you're saying.
So there's no animosity toward the Chinese boards.
No.
I mean, I'm not stoked that a shop's going to come in and import Chinese boards and undercut shapers locally, but I think if those boards came in and were the same competitive prices as us, man, it's a fair game, man. Yeah. You know, we're a capitalistic nation, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, they have just as much right to sell the boards as we do and manufacture. But it does really hurt us when the boards, like a guy that comes and sets a shop up and he's selling boards so ridiculous cheap because he's actually taking advantage of the cheap labor.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Instead of what the craft is to get his boards made.
Yeah.
So I know a lot of guys get their boards made overseas, and it's not about for the cheap labor. It's like they need to get them done, and they still sell them their boards for full price.
Yep.
You know? That's not hurting our industry, you know?
No. But the people that, like you said, you know, they get people with cheap labor, bring them over, sell them for half the price.
It kind of goes against the grain of what we do as a surfer anyways. We're free-thinking people, you know? We're not, like, capitalists to the point where we're like, well, let's maximize our profits by taking advantage of this situation. Oh, sorry. And then, like, just undercutting guys, like I get guys all the time, oh, so and so will do me a board for this price. Like, well, you should go get one from him then.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
because
no respect for the actual.
Yeah, I respect what my craft, I respect what my culture, and
yeah, and what you're about, you know?
And I respect the next shaper. Yeah. I'm not gonna go cut that guy's grass. That's, I don't need to work that bad, you know. It's like, again, I think that goes to tall poppy syndrome, you know. So
not for sure.
I just wish the Australian surf manufacturing industry, the culture of it, guys would work together and froth on each other's, because I could pick up anyone's boards and find something cool about it, you know.
Yeah.
Where another guy would pick up a guy's, another share pick up a guy's board, and you know, kind of critique it, you know.
Yeah. Trying to get. Where
I look for the good thing. There's too much pessimism. Sorry. A lot of pessimistic people.
Yeah.
You know.
Pessimistic.
And I mean, like I've got 3 board orders right now from shapers.
Yeah.
You know, like. And they're looking at me like, why are you ordering a board off me? I'm like, because you did something that looked really cool, and I want that.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, they're so used to other people saying, like, oh, why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? But
I've got some great guys here that have been, like, the Weber family's been very, like, Greg Weber's, like, also one of the top shapers, and to me, design and theory.
Yep.
You can never say there's the best shaper. There's no such thing as the best shaper in the world.
No.
But I think designs, theories, ideas, you know, contours.
Yep.
Definitely Greg's been a really big influence to me. I did have the opportunity to work with him at Lost for a little bit when they were doing a dual label together with Mayhem. But Will Weber is a brother, and he's a shaper. And, oh, man, that guy is, like, you can definitely tell they're cut from the same mold. And,
yeah.
You know, like, Will's making me a board right now. And
you can learn something new from every different shaper,
absolutely.
I guess.
Absolutely.
You know?
Sorry, I was getting another point. There's some really good craftsmen around here, though. We really have a lot of respect for Chris Garrett's, you know, great craftsmen. There's, you know, the Weber family. There's Dahlberg. I mean, there's heaps of guys like down, like even newer generation guys like the Corey Grahams down in, you know, Vico. And there's Maurice Cole, man. Like, he's iconic, you know. There's a lot of great craftsmen and innovators that come out of Australia, you know. It's just seeing the new generation a little bit more bitter and not so, like, you talk to Maurice Cole, and he'll tell you anything you want to know.
Yeah. You need
like, the information's like out there, you know? Not like, oh, this is a secret, because none of what we're doing is secret. We all fucking copy each other.
Well, thanks for tuning in, Smorgasborders. I hope you enjoyed Alex's chat with Greg Weber of Rooster Brand Surfboards. Thanks as well to podcast sponsors Visit Noosa and the Noosa Festival of Surfing. Check you next week, Smorgasborders. Get out there and get wet.